being disabled is not a defect of the human,
right.
is not somehow a detraction from the human, but really essential to who we are, because
right.
we are these limited, vulnerable, dependent creatures. Mm. Being disabled is essentially what it means to be human.
Hey there, I'm Zen Hess. This is Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. Thanks for listening today. I'd like to begin by reading you a quote from the book that we'll be discussing in today's episode. Here it is. In the medical world, genetic screenings and various genetic technologies are understood as obvious goods. Yet the animating metaphysical and ethical assumptions that guide medico-scientific research and application do not always align well with the Christian tradition. Christians ought to be careful not to conflate the goods of medicine with the goods of Christian life. If thinking about how Christian theology can help you think well about the goods of medicine sounds interesting to you, then you will love this episode. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Devin Stahl. She is Assistant Professor of Religion here at Baylor University, and she also co-hosts a podcast called Bioethics for the People. We are discussing her new book, Disability's Challenge to Theology, which is out now with the University of Notre Dame Press. By the way, Dr. Stahl will be joining me as a co-host in a couple of weeks for another episode. We'll be talking with Dr. Aaron Rafferty, a Baylor Press author, with more about disability and theology. So if you haven't already, make sure you subscribe so that you don't miss that episode when it comes out. Okay, now, here's the conversation with Dr. Stahl. Dr. Devin Stahl, thank you for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Yeah, happy to be here.
So in your book's preface, you suggest that Americans have entered a new era of soft eugenics. Let's start there. What does it mean for us to live in an era of soft eugenics?
Yeah, it's such a great question. So I want to start off with just backtracking a tad, because I want to talk a little bit about what we mean by eugenics in general. So, of course, most of us know something about eugenics. Early 20th century, Americans were really excited about the idea of perfecting human beings or bettering society by participating in medical practices that could ensure that our children were well-born, which typically meant either that we were sterilizing people who weren't well-born, mm-hmm. who would potentially produce offspring that were inferior, or that we would improve the race by ensuring that the right kinds of people had children. And so that was a more positive eugenic. And this is pretty unsavory, right? We look back on this and we say, that was a pretty gross thing to do, to forcibly sterilize people. So the government for decades, the American government forcibly sterilized people. Something like 60,000 Americans were forcibly sterilized by the government, both men and women. Mm. And after World War II, we saw what the Nazis did with this,
yeah.
right? So it's embarrassing, but the Nazis got the idea from Americans. We began eugenics. They picked it up and did something really over the top extreme with it.
Mm-hmm.
And when we looked back at that in the 40s, we said, well, that is horrible. We need to also end what we're doing. And in fact, we need to get pretty far away from it. So eugenics was a very dirty word for a long
right.
time. Because of that experience of the Nazis. So we reject eugenics. I argue in the book we actually uphold some of it, but we call it different things.
Mm-hmm.
We population control, things like this. But it really was when genetic science got going that we were able to do things again that monitored children in utero.
Right.
So now we can do genetic screenings, which can lead people to what we call selective termination. So if the child carries some sort of genetic disease or disability, we might have an abortion and try for another child. We developed IVF, in vitro fertilization, which allows us to also screen embryos for genetic markers.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have all this promise of genetic manipulation like CRISPR. So we might be able to actually intervene on embryos and tweak them so that they don't carry the genetic markers that we don't like. And all of that is essentially eugenic.
We
are trying to create a kind of person that we think is desirable. Of course, it's not the government forcing that on us. thank goodness.
Right.
But it's about choice. So parents can choose these things. And that's why it's often called soft eugenics. It's not the hard government forcing it on you.
Sure.
It's all about choice, but it's still essentially eugenic. We're trying to produce better offspring, which is where the word comes from, the better genes.
Wow. And I mean, I think that you're right that it's not an overstatement to say that we've entered into a kind of soft eugenic era. I'm thinking especially of some of the staggering statistics about when genetic disabilities are identified in utero, the number, the percentage of those pregnancies that are terminated is at times just almost unbelievable. Okay, so the genetic sciences raise theological questions. Genetic technologies pose ethical dilemmas to Christians. We've already named some of them here. But you suggest that liberal or mainline Protestant theology struggles to deal with these questions, in part because it lacks a metaphysics or a theology of nature. What's the story here? How did liberal Protestant theology lose its metaphysical way?
It's a good question, right? Because I think most Protestants would say, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Right.
So the first sign that we lost our metaphysical way is that most people have no idea what metaphysics is.
Yeah.
So I sort of define metaphysics in the book as something like how things essentially are, right? Like that's a very lofty, what does it mean for things to be really real? And how are things essentially connected? And that's such a broad question. And I think a lot of people then turn to me and say, like, who cares, right?
Right.
Who cares why, what's really real or how things are essentially connected? It seems like this really lofty kind of philosophical idea. In some ways, it's the most abstract branch of philosophy, metaphysics. But I argue in the book that actually medicine itself has a kind of metaphysics. It presumes things about who we are essentially as persons.
Right.
That's ontology. That's part of metaphysics and how then we're related to the rest of the natural world. And if it has an implicit way of thinking about that, and we as Christians don't, and it's not a like Christianity versus science thing, but if we cede all of that to the sciences, suddenly we don't have anything to say about eugenics, right? Because eugenics is presuming something about what it means to be a person,
right?
And what it means to be a good person, who we essentially are, such that some genetic disabilities might detract from who we are as people, and they're not really part of what it means to be human. And if we think that people with disabilities are really human and are really essentially who we are as humans, then we need a different story. We need a different metaphysic to explain why that would be. So how did we lose this is a great question, and it's a bunch of things. So I start in the book with this idea that, of course, science and theology have not always been at odds. In fact, in the 16th and 17th centuries, they were almost the same enterprise. That theologians, especially after the Reformation, were really excited about this idea that you could know God through knowing the natural world. And so you partnered with what we then called natural philosophers to discover things about the natural world so we could know something about God. These natural philosophers were sometimes called secular theologians, and not because they weren't religious, but you know, that kind of secular, but because they were investigating the natural world rather than God.
Right.
And so you would have theologians partnering with these natural philosophers to say, like, how are we going to discover things about God? And it was really like that coming together that eventually made it so that theology didn't have a lot to offer, right? So theology in and of itself, then natural philosophers eventually said, you know, they're not as good. These theologians aren't as good at investigating the natural world as we are, especially when you get the rise of the empirical method and the scientific revolution. So it kind of eventually the theologians get a little pushed out. And what you get is this like new weird narrative that they've always been in competition, this conflict narrative. Science and religion have always been competitors, which was sort of the furthest thing from the truth. But when that becomes the narrative, Christians have to decide, do we say, okay, yeah, that's right, and actually we don't appreciate this new science? Or do we say, no, we've always been for science? And this was what we sometimes call the liberal fundamentalist divide in American Christianity.
Right.
So Americans had to decide pretty early on, are we the kind of Christians who embrace science, or are we the kind of Christians who reject science? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just science. It was other things about adopting cultural practices. But this was a pretty big part of it. And, you know, when Darwin came out with his theory of evolution, Christians pretty much agreed with it or didn't have a big problem with it. And it was really after this divide and it begins being taught in schools that Christians really start dividing on this question of science. So it's sort of that narrative. It's this idea that we get somewhat from Kant that metaphysics and ethics are different enterprises. Christians should really be more interested in ethics than they are in metaphysics. Mm-hmm. And then there's this kind of literal move away from nature. So a lot, as Americans move from a countryside, from a lot of farming, where they are really invested in like the natural cycles of the environment, and they move into cities, right, where mm-hmm. it's less important to understand nature.
Right.
All of that kind of combines such that a lot of Protestants just aren't very interested in these questions of nature and metaphysics. We'll leave that to the scientists, and we'll do this other thing, this other social ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly we don't have much to say to science anymore.
Right. And you mentioned, you're writing specifically, you name this in the introduction to your book, that you're writing as a member of the Presbyterian Church, USA, mm-hmm. a mainline denomination. And so you kind of say, you know, there's this almost handing over in Christian theology of natural sciences to scientists, and theological kind of reflection maintains its own place in theology, maybe ethics, but disconnected from metaphysics. But you note that there's a different response among the sorts of Christian traditions that PCUSA would be a part of, mainline liberal Protestantism and fundamentalists. Mm-hmm. But it's not like the fundamentalists were opposed to giving science its due and to certain teachings that the scientific community was pushing forward, like evolution. But it's not because they had a more robust metaphysic. You mm-hmm. say it's because of something else. Can you give us a little bit of what you recognize among the more fundamentalist approaches to science and Protestant theology, and why mainline liberal Protestants took a different direction?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a good question. It's not as easy as saying they rejected science, because in fact they didn't reject science.
Right.
What they rejected was the sort of science that eventually would become associated with Darwin, which was the sort of bringing in of the history, which is a complicated way of saying, so there was this empirical way of doing science, right? So we have with the scientific revolution, this idea that you really need to sort of see things mm-hmm. As they are, and then test them, and then gather witnesses. It's actually a very Protestant idea, right? You can't trust your own mind, right?
Yeah.
So we're fallen creatures and we can't trust our own minds. So we need to do things over and over and over again to make sure that they work. And we need a cloud of witnesses to verify that it really happened the way we said it did.
What an interesting analogy. Yeah.
And in fact, a lot of the scientists of the scientific revolution, they would do lab experiments on Sundays, and they would kind of endow the scientific enterprise with a kind of religiosity
mm-hmm.
because they thought it was pretty important to get people on board. And of course, during this time, everybody is thinking in terms of religion. You don't have a lot of atheists in the 16th century, especially in England, right, where a lot of this is happening. So it resembles religion in this important way. It gains traction because of religion. The kind of literalism it's reading from the earth is a kind of same literalism that Protestants are reading in the Bible. So it coheres in a really nice way. But when you have Darwin saying, you know, we can't actually empirically test that creatures have evolved in these ways, that introduces a new way of thinking about science.
Right.
And of course, now I think most people would say, yeah, that's a good way of changing science. It seems to cohere. But a lot of Christians weren't so sure at the time. Like, we accepted this other way of doing science. Mm-hmm. And Darwin's introducing something a little bit different. So George Marson, who's a great historian of this stuff, actually says it's not that these fundamentalists rejected science, is that they cohered to the older science, the science of Francis Bacon and the empirical method. And Darwin didn't seem to be doing quite that. And so they weren't sure about that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You're listening to Currents in Religion, and we are speaking with Devin Stahl about her new book, Disability's Challenge to Theology.
Okay, so we need a metaphysics, and liberal mainline Protestant Christians shied away from metaphysical questions and interrogation for some time, but you want to help recover some of that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do it?
Good. So I think, first of all, it's understanding some of this history. It's understanding what we mean by metaphysics. And then what I want to do with that is say, okay, so science has something really important to say about metaphysics, right? Science is helping us to understand these things, but it's carrying with it some implicit value claims mm-hmm. about humans, about what it means to be a good human or a proper human. If we want to push back against that, we need an alternative story about who we are as human beings. And I focus much on the book. Metaphysics, of course, is not just about human beings, but insofar as I'm talking about disability, I'm talking about humans with disability. And I think an important place to start, right, because I'm a good Christian theologian, is to start with creation.
Yeah.
And so we want to think, what is the Bible, what does the tradition tell us about who we are as human beings in so far as we were created? And there's parts of science that will kind of say, you know, we'll be agnostic about these questions about who we are fundamentally or what we're made for, mm-hmm. right? Darwinism can't tell us what we're for, except right. maybe evolutionary fitness. Mm-hmm. But it at its best, science says, yeah, but we can't say it's driving towards something or right. that we're created by something. We have to be agnostic about those questions. But Christians can't be agnostic about yeah. those questions. We have a story.
Right.
And that story is that God created everything. And I follow a kind of traditional ex nihilo doctrine that says God created everything out of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that is fundamentally connected to God, because God is the creator of everything. And that humans were made in this special image and likeness of God, this imago Dei, which means that we're somehow really fundamentally connected to God. And I'm not sure that's different than the rest of nature, but insofar as we can think about it, we are resembling God in some sort of fundamental way.
Yeah.
Which traditionally has meant that we're like granted this kind of dignity mm-hmm. and this equality amongst human beings. And that we are meant, like, so we were created by God, so we're dependent and vulnerable in important ways, and we're made for God. So part of our work in this world is becoming friends with God, because mm-hmm. that's our ultimate destiny. And so if we're fundamentally vulnerable, dependent on God, and we're meant to be friends with God, part of our life is to sort of work that out.
Yeah.
And so I sort of start with creation, because that seems like a good place to start in a systematic, and then move on to the ways in which, you know, Christ's own incarnation and vulnerability strengthen the ways in which we understand who we are as
right.
fundamentally as human beings, because Christ, you know, incarnated into a human body,
mm-hmm.
the same kinds of vulnerable, dependent bodies that we have, becomes wounded in this life, resurrects strangely into a body that also bears wounds, which I think is super important to the ways we think about how Christ relates to disability. And then, you know, creates a kingdom for us in which all people are fundamentally connected, in which the blind and the lame are invited to a banquet to come as they are, and then invites us to be a church that inhabits the body of Christ and everything that that means. So in some ways you need this kind of the reclaiming of the Christian systematic story about who we are, who we were created to be, and who we're destined to be with.
Right. And so I think for me here, the idea of why a metaphysics matters for Christians wanting to live faithfully in the world really comes into focus, because what you're naming is that all of these theological claims that our story gives to us about who we are and about what the world is, they point to a kind of way of existing as creatures that includes just certain inherent limitations.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that I feel like you draw that out in the book is to say that disability's challenge to theology is to bring those experiences into the conversation in a way that shows that the good life, whatever metaphysics might teach us about the good life, theological metaphysics might teach us about the good life, doesn't negate the experiences of people with various kinds of disabilities and genetic disabilities, mm-hmm. which then poses a challenge to the sciences, at least mm-hmm. from a Christian perspective. So tell us a little bit more about that. I think I want to shift maybe a little bit more to how you connect metaphysics and ethics mm-hmm. or virtues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think part of the problem with a lot of like this history of Protestantism is that it suddenly began to think of these as like separate discourses, that yeah. they don't have much to do with each other.
Metaphysics and ethics.
Right, metaphysics yeah. and ethics. And what I want to say is these are two sides of the same coin. Because in order to understand what we owe to one another, which is sort of the ethics piece, mm-hmm. we have to understand who we are and how we are all essentially connected. So the sort of audacious claim of the book is that being disabled is not a defect of the human.
Right.
Is not somehow a detraction from the human, but really essential to who we are. Because
right.
we are these limited, vulnerable, dependent creatures. Mm-hmm. Being disabled is essentially what it means to be human.
Right.
And
it's not an exception.
Exactly. Yeah.
yeah.
It's not the abnormal.
Yeah.
Right. And that's both sort of metaphysically true, but also like just practically true. All of us at some point in our lives, if we live long enough, will experience disability. And I experience maybe more disabilities than other people as somebody with a chronic illness that is disabling.
Yeah.
And so a lot of this comes from my own, like, how do I understand my disability in relation right. to who I am as a human being? Is this, you know, a curse? Is this a punishment? Is this, you know, just like what it means to be part of the fall? Or is like my disability somehow just fundamentally human?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where I want to land, is that being disabled is not other. It's not somehow worse or bad. I mean, it can be sometimes, but
sure.
fundamentally it's not different than the human. It is essentially a part of who we are. And so what I think Christians need to do is both appreciate that in theory, sure, which is uh-huh. actually quite difficult, because I get a lot of pushback about, you know, no, it really is a defect. It's really, you know, part of sin and the fall. But if I can get you over that hump of that sort of thinking, which I think has been part of Christian thinking for a long time,
mm-hmm.
the next move I want to make is, right, but then what do we do with that? And
right.
I think what we do with that is then we need to like really understand what it's like to have these disabilities
mm-hmm.
from people who experience them. So I want our congregations to know people with disabilities. I want them not to be charity cases. I want people with disabilities to be sort of the central figure in the church
right.
and not the exceptional figure in the church. And what does that mean? It means, I mean, this sounds so simple, but befriending people with disabilities. Understanding their experiences, asking them about their mm-hmm. experiences, and then believing them. There's a lot of really sad literature that shows that even when people with disabilities tell you about their lives, tell you that their lives are good, people just don't believe them.
Oh, wow.
Like we call it the disability paradox, because mm-hmm. people with disabilities consistently show that their quality of life is as high as anybody else's, and people just don't believe them.
Fascinating.
So let's believe them, like
mm-hmm.
let's believe people's experience, and then let's try to work out churches that, like, that's a kind of wisdom, I think. So I get into the virtues, which I think come from a metaphysic as well. So if we think there's a kind of disability wisdom, which I do, and by that I mean, I think the way we perceive the world is influenced by our embodiment.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's true, then people with, you know, different sorts of bodies might experience the world differently and might actually understand the virtues differently, might have a different kind of wisdom from
yeah.
their bodies. And I think we need to cultivate that wisdom. We need to understand that wisdom. And the only way we can do that is by asking people with disabilities about it. I typically get this follow-up question of like, how about people that can't communicate with us? And I want to say, well, first of all, I think everybody can communicate with us. It might not be in the ways that we expect, but everybody is communicating
mm-hmm.
with us, and we need to attune ourselves to that communication.
Yeah.
And the only way to do that, again, is to befriend people, to be part of their lives.
Right. Yeah. You conclude your book with a story published first in the 90s and then
mm-hmm.
again in 2007. I'm forgetting the author's name. But he gives a kind of an account of where soft eugenics could go as mm-hmm. these genetic technologies develop. And in part, the story is a dire one where these technologies become available, but they are only affordable to the wealthy. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, over the course of a couple hundred years, this would lead inevitably to a kind of distinct kind of set of human beings whose genetics have been modified. And now with CRISPR and these sorts of things, we're seeing more tangibly how this could work out. It was a little bit less clear in the 90s. And he says the government would be unable to stop that. Mm-hmm. And I think that that adds a bit of a bit more poignancy even to your argument that, well, if a government can't stop something like a genetic distinction between the poor and the rich, not just in economics, but in genetics, then we need an ethics that can help us to really morally engage with these questions. Mm-hmm. And so I guess by way of conclusion, I'm curious what you imagine some of the role would be between Christian ethics and kind of political discourses mm-hmm. Related to genetic technologies.
Yeah. So I think these discourses are inherently political.
Absolutely.
You know, I think they're framed unhelpfully as private decisions made by couples. Uh-huh. But I want to say to that, as Christians, we're part of a body, right? The body of Christ.
Right.
And our medical decisions should not be private decisions we make between us and our doctors. I say this with a lot of trepidation because
sure.
I don't want to say, I think the government should be part of these conversations too. I definitely don't think that, or that somehow your pastor needs to be involved in every
of
medical
course.
Decision you make.
And I think that you say even in your book that, mm-hmm. that these decisions, you know, they're always going to be complex mm-hmm. and layered, and that's why virtue is necessary.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think instead of sort of that, like that I'm inviting my congregation into the doctor's room with me, instead it's a conversation about, you know, with my Sunday school, which actually I'll be doing this Sunday, about how do we think about people?
Yeah.
How do we think about the purpose of children? How do we think about, as Christians, what it means to surveil our children in utero? What are the goods of that? And what are the potential harms of that?
Yeah.
And so I think it's a lot of training our congregations to think about these questions ahead of time. Because my experience with my physicians, I've just had two kids, and the experience was just a kind of natural, like, yeah, of course, we'll do all the genetic testing, mm-hmm. right? I have a disability. That's kind of the state of things. And in fact, couldn't just say no. They had to ask me several times because they had to ensure that I really knew what I was saying.
Yeah.
And it's easy to just sort of get swept up in that and to just go along with it because, well, they must know, medicine must know, this must be good. This mm-hmm. must be inherently good if medicine's offering it. And it was only because I had had all this training in bioethics and theological bioethics that I was able to say, actually, I need to think about this.
Yeah.
This is not an easy decision. I knew that I was going to welcome my child no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And what would that testing have given me?
Yeah.
It might have given me something. And I think for a lot of couples, it's really important. For me, it was not. And to resist that surveillance, that kind of extra testing was difficult.
Yeah.
And I've never had that conversation in church, but I would have liked to. And
yeah.
I'm trying to bring it to the church I'm in now to say, these are things we should be thinking about. These are, you know, things we should be sort of preparing people for mm-hmm. as they enter into medicine. And it's not just with these sorts of things. I work in hospitals, and I think there's all sorts of ways in which our churches should be helping people think about the ethical way to choose between different treatments or to
right.
choose things in healthcare. And I think I went to seminary. I don't remember talking about it in seminary, so I don't blame my pastors for not knowing this stuff either. But
right.
I think we should be having these conversations, and I think there's ways to do that well. So we can be relying on the doctors in our congregations, the people who work in healthcare, people who do this weird thing called bioethics that I do. I want to have those conversations in church. I don't think they're merely private conversations. I want to prepare people for all the decisions they're going to have to make, whether that's reproductive care or other kinds of healthcare.
Yeah. Dr. Devin Stahl, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks.
Thanks again to Devin Stahl for joining us to talk about her new book, Disability's Challenge to Theology. Remember, Devin will be co-hosting an episode with me in a couple of weeks. So if you enjoyed this conversation, make sure you subscribe so that you don't miss that episode when it comes out. Now, here's Dave Nelson to introduce you to a Baylor University Press author and their new book.
You're listening to The Elevator Speech, an occasional feature of Currents in Religion, a Baylor Religion Department and Baylor University Press podcast. I'm your host, Dave Nelson, director of Baylor University Press. Today on The Elevator Speech, we're joined by Dr. Sarah Jean Barton, assistant professor of occupational therapy and theological ethics at Duke University, and also author of Becoming the Baptized Body, Disability and the Practice of Christian Community. Sarah, thanks for being with us today. What's your elevator speech for Becoming the Baptized Body? What's the big idea?
Thanks so much, Dave, for having me on. So at the heart of my book, Becoming the Baptized Body, is a conviction that theologies of disability need to be deeply responsive to the lived experiences of disabled people in contemporary faith communities. This conviction underscores the book's central argument that the perspectives of disabled Christians can and should inform, shape, challenge, and expand our Christian theologies and our practices of baptism to enliven not only theological dialogues that we might have on baptism, but really to also support avenues for participation in baptismal practices and help folks embrace baptismal identity amongst all Christians, either with or without disabilities. And I think my book's central conviction is related to amplifying experiences of disabled Christians, and that shapes both its content as well as its approach. So in terms of content, it focuses on core Christian practices that people with intellectual disabilities have been excluded from or even denied within church settings. These are things like accessing a Sunday school classroom or a Christian formation offering, not being able to come into a sanctuary space, participating in Holy Communion, and of course, being baptized, the central topic of the book. So instead of focusing on common themes related to intellectual disability in existing work in Christian theology and ethics, themes like friendship or God's image or hospitality or something like inclusion, I explore how baptismal stories and baptismal identities of disabled Christians challenge, expand, and enrich how we think about this constitutive practice of our faith being baptized into Jesus's body. And in taking seriously perspectives of disabled Christians, particularly those with intellectual disabilities, this also means that the shape of my book's methodology prioritized collaborative and inclusive research. So I drew upon streams of thought and practice from ethnographic theology, and that allowed me to partner with disabled Christians through interviews and participant observation and worship together. And this approach to doing theology brought forth three core themes within the book. First, the central importance of belonging to Jesus in our theologies and practices of baptism. Second, our responsibility to have imagination around and support for diverse avenues for embodied participation in baptismal practices among disabled Christians and non-disabled Christians. And then finally, the critical importance of communities in affirming baptismal identity and recognizing the gifts of ministry that are bestowed on all the baptized in the Holy Spirit. So I think baptismal belonging is the work of God in the church today and the church past and the church future. In Becoming the Baptized Body, my book with Baylor invites readers to partner with God in affirming this complex and holy work of belonging alongside and led by disabled Christians for the edification and empowerment of all the baptized.
Mm. Wonderful. It's an exciting book, an important book, and we are grateful to have partnered with you on it. Thank you so much, Sarah, for sharing your elevator speech with us.
Thanks, Steve.
You've been listening to The Elevator Speech, an occasional feature of Currents in Religion, a Baylor Religion Department and Baylor University Press podcast. I'm Dave Nelson, director of Baylor University Press, and my guest today has been Dr. Sarah Jean Barton, author of Becoming the Baptized Body, Disability, and the Practice of Christian Community, now available from Baylor University Press.
Hey friends, it's Zen again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope that you enjoyed it. And if you've got a minute, I'd like to ask you to leave us a review. It'll help us know how we're doing, and it'll also help other people find our show. Also, if you enjoyed the episode, make sure you share it with someone that you think would like it too. Until next week, take care.